The views expressed on this program are the views of the individual broadcaster and do not necessarily reflect the view of Wesleyan University or the WESU management. Hello, and welcome to Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, a progressive-minded radio show about faith and action, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, and WESUFM.org, providing community radio that matters. I'm Maria Johnson. Today, part one of a visit with Colin McEnroe, host of WNPR's Colin McEnroe Show, of which I'm a faithful listener and a big fan. He's got a big, creative, open mind, which is reflected in his wide, sometimes crazy range of topics. And I've heard him mention that he goes to church and that this is something of a new development. As you'll hear, he wasn't raised in a religion, but he's been a seeker for most of his conscious life. And now, unlike so many people who call themselves seekers, he was actually willing to find. Now he belongs to, are you sitting down, an Evangelical Baptist church. But it's not the pinched, narrow-minded kind that phrase may bring to mind. It's led by an inspired pastor with a tragic story and something of a mission to bring Colin along on the spiritual path. He's so humble about the way he's stepping gingerly along it. I'm so glad that when our chat threatened to overflow the banks in terms of time, he generously said he'd stay and talk some more. Part two will air next Tuesday. Same bat time, same bat station. Meanwhile, on the Catholic front, how well will Tim Kaine represent us Catholics on the Democratic presidential ticket? We must pray, I'm serious, that he and Hillary prevail over Trump. Speaking of whom, the first thing Colin and I got talking about is Donald Trump, because on the day that Colin and I talked, he had just aired an episode exploring the inner life of Trump, or actually whether he has one. Back in a moment with Colin McEnroe.
Many dogs and cats spend endless days indoors staring at the wall, living for the moment when you will come home and tell them you love them, take them out, and make a fuss over them. Dogs and cats need physical exercise and mental stimulation, things to do and think about in order to be healthy and happy. Please set time aside for them and give them a real life and real love. For more information, please contact People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals at 757-622-PETA or helpinganimals.com. That's helpinganimals.com.
Welcome, Colin McEnroe.
Great to be here.
I am.
I live in Middletown. Middletown's so doable, too. Like, the streets are wide, you know, and there's like a real town. And
it's close to everything because it's in the middle.
Yeah. Yeah. Hence the name. You know, that had not occurred to me. That's why they call it that.
I'm very smart.
Yeah.
And speaking of that, I just have to say, I've been a fan of yours since even before you were on the radio. Mm-hmm. I would read your columns in The Current and just feel really smart because
Maria came to a lot of my high school classes. That's so early. She got right. Started to get behind me.
I'm telling you, I felt so grateful to have read Beowulf. And to get...
That's a sentence you don't hear all that often, really. But
but really, you are kind of the embodiment of the value of a liberal arts education.
Or the uselessness of it, you know, one or the other.
No, it's wonderful. And then I just have to say by way of, and I'm not blowing smoke, you know, I'm really... The way you cover the state, it makes me feel so lucky that you haven't left because you are paying attention to things that the rest of us are not.
All right, no more praise. No more praise.
All right, that's all. That's enough. I just need you to know. Yeah. Maybe people don't tell you these things. You need to know.
They don't tell me because I'm uncomfortable with that.
Okay. Well, we'll stop then. We don't want to make you uncomfortable. So we are talking on a day when you just had an episode. It seems we talk about sentences that you don't expect to hear, but it was effectively about the inner life of Donald Trump. And
we were talking to Mark Singer from The New Yorker about that, and I think it is an interesting question, and I've been thinking about it a lot in connection with a lot of different public figures. I watched the 8-hour ESPN documentary about O.J. Simpson, and here's this guy who is this just sort of churning machine of narcissism, but with no real end in sight. You know, this is going somewhere.
Yeah, I know. I've listened to you.
So, when I was watching it, I was sort of thinking thoughts appropriate to this particular radio show, because you could tell with OJ that he wanted something, but he didn't know what it was that he wanted. But he thought, because America doesn't really give you that many paths out of where you are to some kind of land of milk and honey. He thought that if he became famous, if he became rich, if he could buy a house in Brentwood, if he could do this, he could hang around with famous people and go to really nice restaurants. And he kept adding to that. And of course, none of the charms on the charm bracelet are any good at all, really. You know, I mean, at least they don't answer that psychic chasm that he's trying to throw gravel into. And I see that a lot. You know, in some ways, I see Donald Trump. I see it. There's sort of two pure distillates that came trickling out of that pipeline 20 years later. One of them was the Kardashians, and the other one was Donald Trump. You know, where in fact now it's just this feedback loop, right, of being famous, right? That's the whole thing. I'm famous. You clap for me. That makes me feel good. I do some more of the things that I'm famous for. You clap for me some more. And you do start to wonder. And so Mark Singer from The New Yorker was wondering way back in 1996, who are you when you're not being that? You know, which is one of the, I mean, you hope that people are, that they have some kind of meta narrative going at some point about themselves and their lives and their place in the universe. But I think you can get tricked into this thing where, wow, I'm just going to pursue that particular golden fleece of being rich and famous or whatever your equivalent of it is. And now we have a guy running for president who, he really doesn't seem like he's thought about anything else except, and including being president, I might add. He hasn't thought about anything else except that sort of feedback loop of just, I'm rich, I'm famous, therefore, dot, 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 you know?
Well, I have a thought and a story, and I'm going to just be obnoxious by telling the story, even though I've told it once before on the radio, but I don't have any listeners, so... It's not,
not today, not today. Lights are just blinking on all over Middletown.
Anyway, regarding, I've lost my thought.
You can tell a story.
No, I had a question. Okay. Wait. No. See, this is why it's so great to be pre-recording. So this past weekend, I went to see a movie, The Innocents. Mm-hmm. Okay. And you have to sit through all the trailers, which are great. You've done a show about trailers. Mm-hmm. I have no objection to it. And there was one trailer for the new Woody Allen movie in which someone quotes the famous line about the unexamined life not being worth living, and then comes the expected quip, which is something along the lines of, well, you know what? The examined life ain't so hot either. So, you know, at the risk of seeming to side with Donald Trump, I mean, it's hard to examine your life and see yourself. And who could blame him for not wanting to do that, especially if he's been the way he's been all his life?
Yeah, and blame me. I don't blame him for that. There's going to be plenty of things to blame Donald Trump for.
Yeah,
but
God,
not examining his own life is not one of them, because that's, I mean, you kind of reap what you sow in that regard. So, I mean, if he's not examining his life, then he doesn't have access to a whole bunch of thoughts and ideas that would otherwise be his, and he also doesn't have access to. I mean, you know, Woody Allen's not wrong. There's a certain amount of anxiety and displeasure that can go along with examining your life, but there's also quite a bit of consolation, or, you know, maybe even the chance of finding a scintilla of meaning in it all.
Well, and we're going to get to that because you go to church.
Right. So I must know what the meaning of life is.
Well, we will explore the reasons why, and maybe it's to get at that scintilla of meaning. Anyway, my story. Back in my reporting days in Rhode Island, I had an encounter with Donald Trump. He was at the factory that was turning out Trump the Game. Okay? This was in nearby Massachusetts circulation area. And so I showed up, and his helicopter landed, and all the ladies on the factory floor who had been to his casinos were all excited, and they said their hearts were going choo-choo-choo. I can still remember. Years later, this was in the 90s, when he had pretty normal hair, actually. Mm-hmm. He seemed like a pretty normal-looking guy. Anyway, so I get up to him, where he's making his way through, and I say, Mr. Trump, you know, on my way here, I asked my gas station guy, Mike, I told him I was coming to see you, and he said he doesn't like you. He says, anyone who has as much money as you have must have stepped on a lot of people. To which Donald Trump replied, I mean, you got to say he's consistent. He said, Mike is right. I have stepped on a lot of people, but I've won. And isn't the world sick of losers? So he's completely himself.
Mm-hmm.
And then because I'd had too much Catholic education, which is to say having money and success is a bad thing, I said, Mr. Trump, we know you're very rich, but are you happy? And he looked at me like I was nuts. And he said, I'm doing all right. Mm-hmm. You know, he's not having any, even now, trouble.
Well, I mean, whether he's having trouble or not, that is a private matter for him, and we'll never know. I mean, I think I would and you would find the kind of life that he lives empty and unredeeming. But, I mean, maybe it's perfect for him.
Maybe his family means a lot to him. I mean, you can at least say that about him.
Absolutely.
Okay. Enough about Donald Trump.
Thank God.
He's a real nowhere man, sitting in his nowhere land, making all his nowhere plans for nobody.
You're listening to part one of an interview with Colin McEnroe, Connecticut's radio raconteur. Now that we've explored the phenomenon of Donald Trump together, we turn our attention to the subject of Colin's decision to start attending church. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from WESU 88.1 FM Middletown and WESUFM.org, providing community radio that matters.
You've heard, I don't have to tell you, you've heard of the nuns, the people who check none when asked, do you practice a religion? Were you a nun?
Yeah, I probably would fit the Pew Research description of a nun, kind of. I really sort of felt, you know, if they limit the number of boxes you can check, you know,
right.
I probably, you know, my answer to the question of religion or faith might have been yes, please, but I didn't really have one, and I'm not saying that I've sort of arrived at the station now either, but I mean, I certainly I wasn't. If I was a nun, I wasn't happy about it. You know, I think that there's more to be had by having something. And I had never really, you know, found any way in that I was comfortable with.
Well, a la Krista Tippett, let's start with your religious background. Did you have one?
No, not really. And I'll tell you, my father was the story can be long or short, but my father was a lapsed Catholic. That doesn't even cover it. No, my father had been kicked out of the Catholic Church by his account at the age of 14. I mean, he tended to kind of dramatize things. I think ultimately—
Well, he was a playwright.
Yeah. I think what my father really was a heretic. He really just liked the idea of being in constant rebellion against religion. So he didn't attend any churches, but he knew a lot about all of them. And I'll give you an example of that in a second. And my mother had been raised a Congregationalist in the very traditional kind of rural New England sense. She grew up in very rural Massachusetts. But I can't say that it made any impression on her, and she certainly had no interest in going to church.
Okay.
And so when I was in about third or fourth grade, I mean, many of my colleagues, my peers, were going to church. And I said, why don't you take me to church? I mean, Jeff and Drew's parents take them to church. And they said, you want us to take you to church? And I said, yes. And they said, well, we'll take you to church. Now, they meant that pretty literally. They would take me to church. The car would open. I would be deposited on the sidewalk, and they would drive away. They'd go home and smoke cigarettes and read the newspapers.
Particular church?
Well, I was a latchkey Protestant, and they would kind of rotate me around as it pleased them. So I started out Presbyterian. I got traded a couple of times. I finished Mainly in the Unitarian Universalist group, and my father would. This, I'm not making this up. My father would, like, when I was a Universalist or a Unitarian, my father would spend an enormous amount of time reading about the history of Universalism and the doctrine.
Okay.
And but he wouldn't go to church at all. He would show up once a year and argue with the minister. And ask a whole lot of penetrating but not particularly friendly questions.
I think psychically he might have been a Jew.
Yeah, I mean, he really had that sort of argumentative quality. But I think basically what he was a heretic.
Okay.
I mean, that's he really wanted to be – that was his role. And I think, you know, it wasn't so much that he didn't believe in God as so much as that he couldn't wait to, like, argue directly with God. He resented having to deal with all these intermediaries. What was odd to us, I mean, he was actually very, very aggressively rejecting of organized religion. When he was sick and dying, somebody, I guess it was probably hospice, sent over this kind of spiritual counselor. Now, they picked the right guy. It was a guy named Sean Kennelly, who'd been a priest in Ireland, and then he decided to get married. And so he wasn't a priest anymore, but he was a spiritual counselor for hospice. And my mother wouldn't let him in. He showed up and rang the doorbell and said, "Mrs. McEnroe, I'm here to talk to your husband." And she wouldn't let him in. He had to talk his way in. It took like three visits. He said to me, "You know the type." He goes, "I used to take care of them in Ireland. You know, the fellow would be dying, and I'd say, 'Paddy, do you renounce Satan and all his works?' And he'd say, 'Father, why make a new enemy at a time like this?'" So that's who my parents were. They were not interested in giving me any kind of religious background. And as when I went to college, I remained somewhat interested in all this stuff. I took a lot of courses.
Let me stop you there just to back up, because I'm curious. As a kid, aside from, you know, Judy and so on, going to church and you're feeling like you were not getting that, did you feel some kind of interest yourself in the subject matter?
I think I did. I mean, I don't know. I don't know how genuinely spiritually curious I was, but I was always very comfortable there anyway, even though I certainly was. I mean, when you're a child, you don't really question what's going on very much. I mean,
dog dies and someone says something about what happens now.
Yeah. Yeah, and I also, I mean, it was pretty damn peculiar to be, like, I was the only kid in any church I ever attended whose parents did not also attend the church. I mean, nobody does this. so, I mean, you know, I don't know. I wasn't ready.
Yeah.
I was kind of up for the structure of it, you know, and you get into UU and there's like these fellowship things where you sit around and talk about what happens if they drop an atomic bomb or something. You know, you start – we were veering away from hardcore spirituality. Right. In sixth grade, I played Jesus in the Easter pageant. But when you're a Universalist Jesus, it's kind of like you don't really have any superpowers or anything. You know?
Okay. So then you go to high school, and it's pretty much like that.
Yeah, and actually what I did in high school, I really was desperate for something. I mean, I look back, and I was desperate.
Okay.
And so I became friends with – I had friends with two boys who were brothers who were very resentfully, you know, enrolled in the Episcopal Church. So I just started going to church with them, and then they got old enough so that they didn't have to go anymore, and I kept going to that too. So I think I really did want something, and I – you know, and then – in college, yeah, I kept studying it. I even had some classes at Yale Divinity School, not with the idea of becoming a minister.
Right.
And then the other sort of pivotal thing was I got out of college and immediately went to work for the Hartford Courant. Yeah. And within about 3 or 4 years, I was their religion writer. It was called religion editor back in those days. So that I must have been only like maybe 2 or 3 years, because I remember I was sent to cover a papal conclave in the Vatican City when I was 23 years old. And I didn't know anything. I was like the worst reporter in the Vatican City.
It's good not to know anything, because then you ask all the questions.
I had a lot to learn. But that was very disorienting.
What do you mean?
Not going to the Vatican City, but being – when you're the religion writer for a newspaper, you deal with somebody different every day, every week. You talk to Catholics, Protestants, Jews, Muslims, Hindus, and that was also during the time when there was a real flourishing of what some people were calling cults. You know, I spent a lot of time talking to people who were Scientologists or Unification Church people or Divine Light Mission. Also, just talking a lot to a lot of people who were Pentecostals or Charismatics or Seventh-day Adventists, Mormons, you know, and you never talk to like the average Mormon because that's not who's going to be in the news. The person you're going to talk to probably is an elder or something. So everybody you talk to is, you know, you don't talk to an average practitioner of Sikh Dharma. You talk to a yogi, you know. So so everybody's pretty much at the top of their game and at a pretty extreme level of commitment. And so it can't all be true. I mean, maybe it can at some real Emersonian level, but it can't, in a granular way, it can't all be true.
Right.
And I ultimately, after, I don't know, a year and a half of that, a lot of the people who do that job, religion editor, they'll stay in it for like 30 years. I was done in about a year and a half. I think I kind of took it too seriously in some ways. It's weird because I would write these very faithful, by which I mean accurate, descriptions of things that I saw and experienced in these churches. And the editors, you know, who are all just, you know, completely hard-bitten cynics, they thought I was making fun of these things. You know, I go, no, I'm not. I don't have no intention of making fun of these things. That's what happened. I'm just writing it.
But back to the conclave, why was it disorienting?
Well, what was disorienting more was the whole pantheistic thing. The conclave was disorienting in its own way, just in the sense that it's the ultimate news event that is not really meant to be covered. So you have press from all over the world, but I mean, basically everything happens in private. You know, first of all, cardinals aren't the easiest people. They're just a buttonhole anyway, you know? before they get shut in, it's not like you can go, they're not giving a lot of press conferences.
Right.
You know, you might happen to see one walking across the Piazza San Pietro or something, and then they lock them all in, and then nobody does any. We said they would make up stuff for us to do, because other than that, they thought we would be just, you know, drunk and perhaps a threat to the community. So they would have these little seminars for us so we could have something to report on. But there's nothing to report on. I mean, I actually got to do a lot of really good stories from there, and I was very, very lucky. I had sort of, you know, the young reporter's dumb luck of just stumbling into some really good stories.
And this was for the election of a pope?
Yeah, it was actually John Paul I.
Okay. Short-lived.
Short-lived John Paul I. And then the Quran said, 55 days later, they said, well, we've never sent anybody to cover anything like that. This, you're the first person we've ever done this with, and we don't have any money now. So I didn't get to do it.
So you don't get to do it.
And I had, at that point, I had all this, I actually knew what I was doing.
Right?
I went back there, I would have been
knowledge.
Would have been more effective,
This is an interview with Colin McEnroe, host of WNPR's Colin McEnroe Show. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from WESU 88.1 FM Middletown and WESUFM.org, providing community radio that matters. The views expressed on this program are the views of the individual broadcaster and do not necessarily reflect the view of Wesleyan University or the WESU management.
Take me to the river.
Well, then, I mean, since after that, I mean, I've just done a lot of different kinds of journalism, lots of different kinds of writing. You know, if anybody examined my writing very carefully, I think they would, and even stuff that I said, I mean, was on WTIC for 16 years, I was actually, with some regularity, bringing up these kinds of issues, probably more than somebody typically in my job would.
Right.
And I mean, maybe not to sort of leap ahead, but at that time, I was on WTIC for 16 years. I was doing, basically, I was the house liberal in an otherwise very conservative radio station. But I was trying to do a show. It was an afternoon drive show, and I was trying to do a show that was sort of for thinking people, too,
right,
you know?
Right.
So it wasn't all reflexive politics. It was about all kinds of stuff, including spirituality. We would talk about that.
Okay.
We talk about anything. There was a woman named Nancy Butler who was at that time going to Yale Divinity School at a kind of a second career kind of way. And she was driving back and forth from Glastonbury to New Haven. And she would listen to me do this show. And I think she could pick up pretty well that I was interested in these things. And at a certain point, she got all done with Yale Divinity School. And then she started emailing me saying, you know, I'm starting my own church. And it's going to be in the old G. Fox building in Hartford. You know, you should come see it. And she probably did this, I don't know, more than once I got these emails. And I just thought, well, that looks very interesting. And she seems like a very interesting person. And I'm very busy. And yeah. I never did it, which I sort of deeply rue at this point because of what we're going to be talking about later in the show. But I think the fact that Nancy even then, I mean, she wasn't doing that with a lot of other journalists or probably any other journalist. I think she was hearing something in what I was saying that suggested maybe I'd be interested in this.
Something perhaps that maybe you weren't even aware that you were revealing.
Yeah, I think I say yes and no to that. I mean, I think I always have known. I mean, when the truth is, when anybody would ask me about my spiritual state or whatever, I would always say I'm a seeker. You know, I'm really am seeking. I really am looking.
And you really, really were?
Yeah, I think I really was. I mean, I really...
In the way of reading and
reading,
thinking,
meditating.
Okay. Meditating in the really formal Buddhist sense?
Not with my... Although then, I mean, I also did very... I mean, like really hardcore yoga for 5 years, and there's a lot of... Yes. Spirituality in that, whether people want to believe that or not. But I think more just asking a lot of questions and being intrigued by, you know, if you're not embedded in any particular faith, then you see things every once in a while or you'll read something that, you know, I used to love this Canadian novelist, I still do, Robertson Davies. He didn't write exactly about faith. He wrote about but all of his characters were very attuned to the possible the dualities, you know, the notion that there's this world and then there's probably something else, you know. And then they all had very, very different and very colorful ideas about what the something else was. And I loved that. I loved that idea that I wanted to be in the Toronto that he was describing where there would be these smart people who – had made a point of reading and absorbing and practicing things that were maybe a little bit esoteric and that were in some way connected to their spiritual lives, or they wouldn't even call it that, but just an awareness that the world is not that simple a place.
Well, and just today on today's show, you mentioned Henderson the Rain King by another Canadian-born author whom I love. Saul Bellow. And that character, I want Henderson, he has this voice, and he ends up going to Africa. I won't, you know, go into the story too far, but did Bellow's writing resonate with you?
I wasn't a huge Bellow guy. Yeah, I did mention Bellow today in connection with Trump. He wasn't one of the ones who really spoke to me.
Okay, but this other guy did. I'm going to have to look him up. So, all right, so you're reading and seeking and thinking, and maybe along your reporting way, somebody has a approach to life that resonates or not. But in any case, Nancy, if I can call her Nancy, she picks up on something, invites you to her church.
I never went.
And you never went. Never went.
Never went.
Okay.
No.
And
let me help you with part of the transition here, too. When I get to – it's interesting. When I was on commercial radio for 16 years, when I would talk about religion, I would often talk about religion kind of playfully, too, you know, and or comically or something. Yeah. And no matter what I did, it made religious people really angry, you know.
That's why we have a code key on the door here.
They'd be really angry, and they'd be calling me up, and I'd be going, you know, I don't really mean any harm by this. I just assume that if God made all of us, I mean, where did we get our senses of humor from, if not from God? So, I mean, I just assume he's got a sense of humor, too. Okay. So, but that didn't necessarily mollify anybody.
No,
but, I mean, that's what
satisfying.
That was sort of – and then I went over to NPR, and I had the exact opposite – set of experiences, which is that public radio listeners tend to be more agnostic or atheist. They're very distrustful of organized religion. I mean, I did not too long into my time at NPR, I put Peter Rosazza, the auxiliary bishop of Connecticut, on for.
I was on that show.
Yeah, that's right. You were on that show.
And I was going to mention, I don't think you got any callers.
No, and people were mad. I got emails from people saying, that's rank superstition. I don't listen to public radio. To hear that kind of thing.
But we should say why you had the bishop on. Mm. What was the theme of that show? It was about, I think, Pope Francis, right? It was about...
Yeah, I don't remember what we were talking about. I think it was just sort of a chance to talk to him Well, he may have been on more than once. There was one time where I had him on just to sit there for an hour and talk.
Yeah, because he's a great guy.
Yeah, he's just a really interesting guy. I've known him since his, you know, consecration.
Wow.
But the reaction to that and to several other things like it among not all of the public radio audience, they don't speak with one voice, but there was a lot of, you know, we don't really do this stuff. what are you doing? This is public radio. That's what they're saying is we're rationalists. We equate public radio with a kind of rationalism that therefore doesn't really have a lot of room for anything that might be considered faith. Yeah. Or, but the, you know, also this has coincided, as you know, with the rise of the kind of atheist horsemen of the apocalypse,
yeah.
With Chris Hitchens and,
right.
and Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins and Daniel Dennett, who I spent an evening with earlier this year, or I guess it was in December. But
why are you laughing?
Well, I'm laughing because, I mean, I actually, first of all, I'm laughing for two reasons. One of them is because it turns out that, you know, the only thing as obnoxious as a very aggressively proselytizing, censorious Southern Baptist with no room in his heart, you know, for anybody else's truth, especially people who are, you know, heathens and atheists, is an atheist who has exactly the same attitude. And
right.
really, it's you don't have to go very far. I wouldn't have to walk very far around Middletown to encounter such a person,
right.
you know, and they're they're intolerant, which is sort of weird. You wouldn't ever think that an atheist would be intolerant. We think that that's what religious people do, which and we're not wrong. There are plenty of intolerant religious people. But so I'm laughing partly because of that, and then partly because I did this thing with Dennett where we talked at the Twain House in front of a live audience, and I sort of got what my job was, which is, I mean, they want to, he's got fans, you know, these people, they have fans and okay. they want to hear him play his hits basically.
Right.
So I just, there were a couple of things where I thought, you know, we could have a really interesting conversation and I would bring them up and I could just tell that he didn't want to do it and the audience didn't want to do it.
They
and,
just wanted the shtick.
Yeah, they want to hear the hits.
Yeah.
And so.
God, that's so disappointing.
Well, I mean, it's not, I don't consider it disappointing.
No?
I mean, it was.
It's a lost opportunity.
We could have had a really interesting conversation. We had dinner together before we did this thing. And I love being able to do that before I go in front of a live audience with somebody. I
right.
very typically do. Try to have meals with them or hang with them somehow to get a measure of who they are.
Yes.
And I could just sort of tell, you know, I mean, he didn't come to Hartford to
seek the truth.
Or not to seek the truth. No, I mean, I don't, that would make me the repository of the truth and I don't.
Well,
make
no,
that
the
claim.
Exploration of it together.
I just think he didn't come to Hartford to play table tennis with anybody.
Yeah. Okay.
And like, I think I would have been a pretty good table tennis player with him, but he just, that just wasn't what he was there for. And I read that right away. And
so
I
he was there to put forth his party line.
Yeah. It was, and you know, to be fair to him and to them and everybody, it was basically billed as an evening with Daniel Dennis,
not
an evening with Colin McEnroe and Daniel Dennis playing table tennis.
But so, I'm sure you challenged him on some of his.
And some stuff. But I mean, you can, I've been doing this kind of stuff a really long time. You can tell right away whether that's in the cards, and it just wasn't in the cards.
Okay.
So I was sort of laughing at that memory because I'm interested enough about this stuff and flexible enough in my thinking that I would have really enjoyed talking about how you look at quantum mechanics and spirituality side by side, or something that you
right.
could, a question like that that you could explore with a guy with his level
firepower.
Of intellect, that
right.
would have been really fun, but it would just, you know, but I also got why that wasn't going to happen.
Okay. So where were we?
No idea.
This is an interview with Colin McEnroe, host of WNPR's Colin McEnroe Show. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, providing community radio that matters.
I'm Dick Gregory with PETA. Martin Luther King Jr. taught me the fight against oppression is never an easy one. It's even harder if you have no voice. For animals held captive in circuses, life consists of cramped cages, shackles, and daily beatings. There is no escape. They cannot demand their freedom. Images like these bring only one word to my mind, slavery. Be an abolitionist for the animals. Please don't go to circuses. For more information, contact PETA.
757-622-PETA.
There's a strange news.
Now, it turns out, as you get to know the audience better, it's a big audience, many right. thousands of people, and they're not all Daniel. They don't even all know who Daniel Dennett is.
Right.
There are people like all over the spectrum of, you know, of faith and every other kind of spectrum.
Not to go off on a tangent, but I always was wondering why Krista Tippett changed the name of her show from Speaking of Faith to On Being. Do you think it's related to this NPR thing?
It was because of Faith Middleton, actually. Too many people thought it was about faith. No, I'm kidding. That's no, I don't know the answer to this, yeah. although in the conversation that we had that day, I said to her, when you started to launch the show Speaking of Faith, was there pushback?
Yeah.
And she said, yes, there was a lot of pushback in NPR newsrooms, the same kind of pushback I'm talking about.
Right.
Why are you doing this?
Right.
Now, she pushed through that pushback and you know, created a very viable franchise. I think ultimately the reason it's called On Being is because she wants to be able to interview all kinds of people.
Right. Who don't have faith.
Yeah, or who, you know, who are poets or whatever.
Right,
you know?
Right,
and
right.
So I think she wanted now, and it was a smart move. It's like you can't really disqualify anybody, you know. Well, that you can't put that person on being. That person doesn't. that person doesn't be.
Isn't being.
Yeah. Everybody bees, you know.
Let a thousand flowers be. Yeah. All right. So back to your spiritual life. So you're not going to Nancy's church, and mm-hmm. you're going about your busy, I'm assuming, life, mm-hmm. not just radio life, but writing life mm-hmm. and family life. And something must have happened at some point where you decided, I think I'm going to go to church.
Well, what happened was, no, actually, it was journalism came first.
Okay.
Kind of. So I have this ridiculous social media, you know, thing.
Yeah.
So I have 5,000 friends on Facebook and 3,000 followers or whatever.
Okay.
And so somehow or other on Facebook, and okay, let me just sort of back up and just say one thing, which is at any point in this narrative, you can make the argument, well, whose voice was that? Who was really telling you to do that? Who made sure that you saw that on Facebook? Because I really do. I mean, when you have a really big Facebook feed, I mean, I'm maxed out. I have 5,000 friends, and then you can have followers on top of that. I think that's almost 4,000 now. You just don't see everything that everybody posts, right?
Right.
I don't.
Right.
I just,
right.
I can't. There's no way. I mean,
right.
so.
That's why I'm not on Facebook.
Yeah. So you see whatever pops up, you know, in front of you for whatever reason, having to do with their algorithm and
right.
what day it is and what time you happen to be looking. So somehow or other, I saw this woman, Nancy Butler, whose name had never left my head in all these years,
yes.
saying that she had ALS.
Oh.
And I thought, wow, she's the pastor of this church,
yeah.
and she's got ALS, which is the ultimate test probably of
yeah.
your faith, or about as big a test as I could imagine anyway. And I just, okay, and here's the point where Nancy, if she were here, would say, and then God told Colin that he had to reach out to me. So you can either decide that's true or that it's not or that you don't know. But I did. I immediately I did know I had to do this. Like sometimes you just know.
Right.
And so I immediately sent her a message saying, how would you like to come on my show and we'll just talk for a whole hour about what you're going through and how that interplays with, you know, who you are as a person of faith. And she took her a little while to get the message, but when she got it, she immediately said yes. And so I thought, well, I better go to her church now before she goes on the radio with me. I've got to see what the church is like. The church has moved. It's not in the G. Fox building anymore. It's in this community center down in Glastonbury. And so I went down there, and I went to a service, and I went, and my immediate reaction was, oh, no, this would never be for me. It's just so wrong.
What was it about it?
Well, the music seemed wrong to me, and the feel of it seemed wrong to me. And the tradition that's being evoked here is an evangelical Baptist tradition.
Wow.
I have to then append to this that, like, this is nothing like most people's mental image of an evangelical Baptist church. We at this moment have multiple pastors because Nancy's incapacitated. We have gay pastors. We have lesbian pastors. Okay. We have gay and lesbian people who have other positions of importance in the laity.
Does this church affiliate with a denomination?
It is part of the American Baptist Convention. American Baptist Church, which is also the kind of more mainstream, mainline Protestant version.
Okay.
So, I mean, we're Baptists because we immerse people in water once a year. I mean, but
very cool, by the way.
Yeah. We now do it in... When this disease came, she and Greg got a different house that was more handicap accessible, and it had an indoor pool, which seemed like a good idea too. So that's where the people get baptized now. But anyway,
that's awesome.
So anyway, I walked in there and I thought, this is not me. This is not me. I don't like the music, and I don't get this, and it's not, you know, even as a latchkey Protestant who's been to a lot of different kinds of services, and then as a religion editor, I was in all kinds of services, including ones like this. Although there's nothing quite like Riverfront Family Church in a lot of ways. But I just sort of thought, this is a nice place to visit. I'm certainly not going to live here. And then it was still a little bit of time before we were going to do the interview. And I somehow or other found myself going back the next Sunday so that I would have gone to two services before I interviewed Nancy. So, which is more, you know, than typically a host will do for something like that. And because I do 5 shows a week, I can't be preparing that much. But... And then, you know, I just there were 2 things that happened. One of them was that I realized that I felt better when I walked out of the building than when I went in, which has not necessarily been my experience with church all the time. And the other one was that it felt like a place where I could think about things that I don't get to think about most of the time. You know, just kind of getting through your life, getting through your day.
Right.
There just isn't this moment where you can really maybe concentrate on some of these questions I had these first 2 very strong sensations about this. And so there's been, other than if I'm away, there's been no break in my attendance. I think there was one day in the last, that was in April, maybe late April of 2015. So we're now, it's July 2016 now. I think there might have been one Sunday where I just didn't go because I didn't feel like it. But that's the only time.
If I'm
here.
You're allowed.
Yeah, if I'm here physically in Connecticut,
no.
I'm at this thing.
And you go alone?
My son goes with, has
Mortimer.
Gone with me. Yeah, Mortimer. We can say his real name now. His real name is Joey. He has sort of fits and starts about going. I think he mainly goes, he's 26 now. He likes to go do stuff with me.
Okay.
So he'll go with me sometimes. And he really likes the people there a lot.
Well, that's great.
And so, I mean, Joey's favorite part is like after the service when everybody schmoozes.
Right.
Joey's much more of a schmoozer than I am. And so.
Was there a moment when you told your significant other, you know what, I'm going to go to church? And was there a reaction? Like, really? What?
Well, no, there was nothing like that.
You think you know a person.
There was nothing like that. No, I don't know. We're pretty comfortable, the two of us, about. So my significant other she would say that she's a Catholic. Now,
we should have her on the show.
Yeah, well, good luck. Good luck with that. So she was brought up in the Catholic Church.
Okay.
She goes to church now mainly for funerals. But if you're, you know, Irish, you can go to a lot of church services.
Yes.
Going to funerals. So
people are getting older.
She didn't really go to church on Sundays or anything like that, or go to services.
Okay.
But I mean, that's she.
But she wouldn't check none.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Okay.
And there was, after I'd been involved in Riverfront for, I don't know, 8 or 9 months, there was one day where she said to me, "Do you mind that I don't go?" And I said, "No, I don't." I said, because of exactly what you just said, Maria, because I don't think of you as somebody who doesn't have a religion or some kind of faith journey or whatever. I mean, I think you're a Catholic. I don't, you know, you maybe don't do a whole lot of Catholic things, but I think of
it's
you
in
as
your
a
bones.
Yeah, I think of you as a Catholic.
Yeah.
She's probably going to go to church with me for the first time ever on August 14th.
What's that?
So I have to sort of fast forward a little bit. So ALS is this very insidious disease, and it just like takes 5% of you every month. It just like every month it just takes 5% of you. And we only have 100% of us, right? So as this goes on, so there's less and less of physically of Nancy left. Everything that's spiritual about her is 100%, and her brain is 100%. You know, all that stuff is 100%. Her sense of humor is 100%, but her body is, I don't know what percent, but it's not a great percent, whatever it is. And that has gradually degraded her power of speech.
Oh.
So lately, so there was like, she gave this sermon that was sort of the last sermon, like, I'm never going to give another sermon.
Yeah.
And then...
How hard?
It was hard. Yeah, all of this has been, I wish I could describe it for people, the way it's been hard and the way it's been not hard.
Okay.
And like every hard thing that we've been through as a congregation, as a group, has also been kind of wonderful.
If you're just joining us, this is part one of a chat with Colin McEnroe, host of WNPR's Colin McEnroe Show, about his having found his spiritual home at Riverfront Family Church in Glastonbury. If you're interested in the church yourself after listening to Colin, you can find it online at riverfrontfamilychurch.com. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from WESU 88.1 FM Middletown and WESUFM.org, providing community radio that matters.
Sure, humans can be a little weird at times, but take it from me, I'm a dog. And a person is about the best thing that can happen to a shelter pet. So if you want to learn how you can be that person, get down to your local pet shelter or visit theshelterpetproject.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Go to the waters of Arimir, the river will be wise and ease.
Yeah, there was this last sermon. And then like the Hartford Seminary, where she had also attended, in addition to Yale, Div, they wanted her to come and give a talk. Because at this point, you know, I don't know, I think there'd been a lot of publicity on my show and some other, and also the people at Hartford Seminary, they know her and they knew about what was happening. So we went to Hartford Seminary for this evening speech. And the way that Nancy had all worked it out was that, so all these people from Hartford Seminary are there, and people from the Hartford community. The Butlers are very, very well known. Her husband's a very prominent guy at Eversource. And so there are people from the Hartford community. But our whole congregation showed up, you know, like we haven't ever heard Nancy Butler speak, but just like for support or whatever.
Well,
we're all there, you know,
the whole. That just, makes sense.
Yeah, it's just like another Sunday, basically. So we're there. And the way that she kind of parceled it out, so her daughter is ordained and is now one of our pastors, and her husband, Greg, and she had some video. She did this kind of multimedia thing where she could talk. At that point, she could still talk.
Okay.
But she couldn't talk like for 20 minutes.
Right.
So she'd say a little bit, throw it to the video, or throw it to Greg, throw it to Liza, throw it to whoever, I can't remember else, whoever else talked, there were other people. And I came up to her afterwards and I said, you know, you could just keep giving sermons that way. Just break it all up.
Yeah.
So since then she has done some other sermons that way. But now we're in a different place.
Right.
And so there isn't really probably any way that she could speak any of her sermon. She can speak, but it's well, let me finish the August 14th thing. So on August 14th, Nancy is very manipulative. So I
in a good way.
Yeah, the way that I what I agreed to was I'll give your sermon. In other words, I'll speak your sermon. You write it, I'll speak it. I'll be your voice. But see, that's not how Nancy operates. So that's what I agreed to do. Instead, she clearly, because one of the last things she wants to do here on earth is do some of the spiritual carpentry on me. And so
she perceives a need there.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. This is, I mean, she would, if she were sitting here, she would say this is one, it's not the only one, but, you know, on the list, on her to-do list with her time left on earth, I am, you know, I'm in a fairly short part of the to-do list that, you know, she really wants. She feels there's something in me that she's trying to help me find. So so it turns out we're going to kind of work on this sermon together. It's all based on the 19th Psalm. And so anyway, that's why my significant other is coming to church on the 14th.
I want to bring up the column that you wrote about, well, it was about kindness, really.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really affecting. You were clearly affected by what was happening to her. And just talk a little bit about that about your, do you feel changed by?
Oh, yeah, totally changed, yeah. But yeah, to the column that you're talking about, it was sort of a weird day. I was having kind of a bad day as a newspaper columnist, just in terms of getting along with editors. And I wasn't working that week. I'd just taken some quiet time. And I'd said to Nancy, who can't read anymore, that I would come. She has, you know, caregivers who read to her and friends who read to her. And I said, that day I'm going to come out. She lives way out in Marlboro. And I said, I'm going to come out and read to you. Mm. And so I had brought Emerson's Harvard Divinity School speech. We would decided that I would read that to her. And that is a big chore. But it's also the greatest graduation speech ever. Mm-hmm. And so we went through it, and it was it took a long time because we'd stop and say, well, what about this? What about that? How does that relate to something somebody said in church 3 months ago or whatever? So it took a long time to get through this. It's a 7,000-word speech. And I got in my car to drive back. And, you know, it's funny because we just did a show about clouds, but it was this very beautiful day and there was this bright blue sky and there were these clouds up there. And I just started crying. I was crying for all kinds of different reasons. But there was one, once again, the same voice that said, you have to reach out to Nancy Butler, you know, was kind of saying, you have to write about this, you know, and I'd written this very negative column and I was having arguments with my editors about
it. It was a mean-hearted column. About someone.
To say there's a public official who really caught a break or somebody in the public eye really caught a break this day. But this voice was just saying, well, screw that column. You're not going to do that column. You're going to go back right now and you're going to write about this.
Yeah.
And so that's what I did.
God bless you and keep you all the days of your life, because there's something brave about that.
I know what you mean. It doesn't feel that way to me. In fact, where I feel the safest these days. Yeah. I mean, when I go to church now, it really is kind of like, first of all, the one thing I don't want to be is like Colin McEnroe. I mean, the day I wrote that column, well, the day that it ran or it'd been sitting around online for a few days and so I went to church on Sunday, and I thought, oh, please, I hope we don't talk about this. And not because I'm resistant to the material. And we have an unusual church format. I always say we're Quaptists because there's this Quaker part of the service where there's a sermon, and then there's a little period of meditation, and then anybody can say anything. You know, and people talk about all kinds of stuff. Yeah. And I kind of knew somebody would say something about the column, but I just didn't want it to be like – My when I go there, I want to be as much like everybody else as I possibly can. And I know that what's going on between me and Nancy can be a little bit of a distraction, because some of it is inevitably going to
be bleeding out into
it's going to take place in public. But I mean, and that just is going to happen, and I don't think there's any getting around that. But I didn't want, just in terms of whether that's brave or not, I feel this is where I feel safest. Yeah. And in some ways, even though I don't consider myself, I said at the Hartford Seminary thing, I'm in terms of the power ranking of our church, in terms of who's a real Christian, I'm the lowest in the power ranking. But I said I also could be this year's most improved Christian, so I could get that trophy,
Let's talk about that. You say you're changed. Can you sum up? We only have a few minutes left, but how would you say you're changed by the experience? It's not just of going to church, but of working with Nancy and knowing Nancy. You feel some kind of softening inside?
Yeah, definitely softening inside. And just, look, if you're going to spend, and I really don't consider myself to be some, Christian warrior or something, but if you're going to spend a lot of time with the Bible and thinking about this stuff and talking about this stuff, you don't have. I mean, I can't quite figure out how people manage to be mean Christians. There are a lot of really mean Christians. This is a big. If we had more time, I'd tell you about this.
Do you have time?
Yeah, I do. Sure,
you do. Because I'm inclined to keep rolling here and do this in two episodes.
Okay, I can do that.
Okay. Because I don't even know who's supposed to come in here after me. We'll just talk until someone knocks at the door.
So back in October.
That was part one of a chat with Colin McEnroe on his decision to attend the Riverfront Family Church in Glastonbury. If you missed any of the episode, you can find it archived online at wesufm.org and at reasonablycatholic.com. Part two of our talk will air at the same time next Tuesday. And that's all for this episode of Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith. Thanks for listening. I'm Maria Johnson. Stay tuned for The Jive at 5, followed by Acoustic Blender with Bill Revel.